We are the image of God. That is, we are his physical representatives so that we can rule over creation on his behalf.
The Bible is made for this. Like, it talks about supernatural entities that are real, that aren't imaginary. And I think the church has to wake up to this.
Do you think that whenever she came out of the water, that there was a demon came out of her?
It's like, I can understand that, because our human nature is to, you know, take the blessings that God gives us and then forget about them tomorrow.
There is an intelligence at war against them. And I think what I'm suggesting is that there are still intelligences that we're at war against.
I really like what Dr. Michael Heiser said a lot, is that God's desire is to dwell with mankind forever.
All of the nations in the world have been assigned a particular overseeing guardian to watch over them. But that in particular, the nation of Israel has been designated to be solely God's chosen nation.
The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone.
But our enemy has not laid down their arms. Their power is broken. Christ is King, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, mighty.
I was at one time the fastest sword driller in the county.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Two Trees Podcast. My name is John Dillon, and I'm here without my usual friends, but I have brought you the greatest of the Yankees, who's not really a Yankee, he's a Red Sox kind of a guy, I would assume. He's from Boston. His name is Mike Chu, friend of the podcast and an all-around great guy. Mike, welcome to the Two Trees.
Thanks, John. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you here. It's always fun when we get a chance to listen to what you've been thinking about. And you are recently recovered from a horrible sickness where you died and came back to life several times. And through the miracles of chicken noodle soup, you are now ready to roll on into the rest of life.
Yep, chicken noodle soup, the price spiked with a little bit of some antibiotics. I have no idea what it was. We initially thought it was the flu. The flu test came out negative. We thought it might have been strep. The strep test came out negative. Was it like, oh no, COVID? 5 days worth of testing, nothing came out. So all I can assume that it was probably, it's like let down, like, I don't know, backwoods cousin, bovid, that somehow got me. I have no idea what it was. And I'm still slightly recovering from it, so excuse my voice if it sounds a little hoarse. COVID has been like raking me over the coals too, so yeah.
No, I'm just glad you're back. We tried to record a while back and he said listen man, it's not gonna happen. I am feeling bad, and but you're up and you're moving, and it's just really, I appreciate you making the time to talk with us. You're a pretty busy guy and you've got a lot going on, but you've been chewing on really image of God stuff and talking about the creation and the importance of the meta narrative throughout scripture. And Mike just got done preaching to me for half an hour here and just being a blessing to me as we were really just, I unloaded on him, and he was just such a good friend. So I want to tell everybody out there what a great guy you are. But Mike, why don't you share with the folks a little bit about what you've been chewing on and thinking about, especially as it relates to the sermon series you've been working on.
So the sermon series, it's been a bit like a two-parter sermon series. It's essentially two sermon series, but they built up into one another. And so the one that I was working on previously was essentially about foundations. And the sermon that I got to preach was about the importance of the image of God, but also how it relates to the fall, how it relates to the looking at the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And so in the sermon that I preached, I had to essentially cover Genesis 1-3, which is insane. That is not something I would ever recommend to people to do normally. But in the context of my community, I felt there was an importance to at least make sure to get everyone on the same page of understanding who was the creator in Genesis 1, the creation story about humanity in Genesis 2, and then noticing the narrative of what was going on with the fall as woman looked at the tree of knowledge and was tempted and eventually gave into the temptation to take that fruit. And so a lot of that has just been this processing and percolating about what is the image of God. And so some of the things I just wanted to bring out to not repeat from what I mentioned in the sermon series was some of the cool things I discovered in my study of Genesis 1 and then also about Genesis 3, ironically. And so let me just take a look back here. I'm going to look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Now, this is the famous verse where is often said about this is where God creates humanity. And especially if those of us who are familiar with a divine counsel worldview, that this is not just simply God talking amongst himself, in other words, the Trinity, but that he's also addressing the greater counsel, all of the Elohim, the supernatural spiritual beings that were also created. So in Genesis 1, verse 26, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground.'" And in verse 27, it sounds similar. "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." So one of the cool things that I had discovered is, you know, we've been familiar now with this idea that when God created humanity, he created humanity to be his image bearers. Mm. And image bearing being in the sense that we are his representatives in the creation world.
Right.
One of the interesting things, though, is that for a long time, especially these last couple of years for me, the word image and likeness, it was assumed that they were just simply synonyms, right? That they're essentially doing a typical Hebraic practice, which is emphasizing a core idea. And so they're repeating the core idea twice, mm-hmm, to kind of emphasize. And so image, likeness, they're the same. Many scholars, including folks like Carmen Imes, would agree with that. However, this past November, I was at my first Evangelical Theological Society conference. I've always been wanting to go. I finally went. I was waiting till I actually graduated with an MDiv so I actually could just actually say, yes, I finally actually have a degree. And so I got to go there. And one of my professors at Gorham-Conwell, Catherine McDowell, was presenting a paper at one of the seminars. And so I went to that seminar. And unbeknownst to me, the first person to actually present was Peter Gentry. And Peter Gentry, if folks don't know who he is an Old Testament scholar who also deals with a lot of divine counsel type materials. He goes into a lot of Old Testament text criticism. He's just a really good scholar. And unfortunately, some folks who are familiar with him within the divine counsel worldview, they assume that he isn't friendly to it. I would say he's probably more agnostic to it. He's sort of like in the middling position between Dr. Heiser, Dr. John Walton. He acknowledges it's there. And he just doesn't, you know, that's not his forte. But he will bring it up whenever he encounters it in the text. And so at this seminar, he was presenting a paper talking about the question, is there a difference with the word image and likeness in Genesis 1:26. And he essentially wrote a book here called Biblical Studies, Volume 1. It's a collection of three essays recently that he's written. And, you know, to spare folks from reading all of the material, because he essentially goes into the languages, into the word history, into all the different, you know, cognate or similar languages in Hebrew.
Nope, don't spare us. But I'm ordering it right now, so hang on while I pull it up. Okay, go ahead.
I will read simply his conclusion. So to prime folks up, Genesis 1:26, when we see the word image, that the Hebrew word behind it is the word tselem. When we see the word likeness, the word behind that is demut. And so for the longest time, I had assumed they were just simply synonyms, that image is like likeness, likeness is like image, so on and so forth. Not a big deal. But in his first chapter, essentially his whole entire like essay about these two words, he essentially found there is a difference. There are nuances in what's being communicated. And so to break it down, to summarize, before I read this section, demut, which is the word for likeness, to simplify it, what it really indicates is actually the vertical relationship that humanity has to God. So in other words, when we see the word likeness, God is simply saying humanity is in direct relationship vertically between me and humanity. They are going to represent me. They are functioning similar to me. Mm-hmm. And when we see the word tselem or image, it's talking about the horizontal relationship of a king, a regent, to his people. And so in relation to the creation story, there is something that's going on here where humanity is being compared to, there is a horizontal relationship aspect about being made in the image of God. The horizontal aspect probably being with rest of creation. And so with that little teaser, I'll read his summary section about the two words. So this is Peter Gentry. Page 22, the meaning of demut and tselem in Genesis. Let us now consider the occurrences of demut and tselem in Genesis in light of the lexical study. The one and only supreme creator deity announces to the divine council in Genesis 1:26 the decision to make Adam. The adverbial modifiers in our image and according to our likeness indicates a vertical relationship between humans and God that can be described as obedient sonship and a horizontal relationship between humans and all creation that can be characterized as a servant kingship. Mm. The preposition A indicates that humans represent the creator God in the world precisely, while the preposition ka, heading, likeness, shows that our generation is similar but not precise to that of God. As I explained in Kingdom Through Covenant, God addresses the divine assembly but proceeds to create humans in his own image and likeness and disenfranchises the divine assembly by assigning the ruling function to the humans. There's already a lot to unpack from that. What Dr. Gentry is getting at is that when we read Genesis 1:26, he's getting down to that the words of image and likeness and even the prepositions before those Hebrew words indicate that there is a special type of function and special type of representation that humanity is meant to do, that we are meant to actually live out. And that ironically, yes, we are made similar to like the Elohim. There's a reason why, as Dr. Ron Johnson will love to say, I can walk my dog, but I don't talk to my dog. Like I don't have a personal relationship with my dog on a really deep level. But with the Elohim, with other divine beings, with spiritual beings, with God himself, some reason humanity actually can have a relationship, can actually dialogue, can have communion with them. Why? Because we were made similar to them. Mm. But there is something, there's a nuance that Gentry just kind of pushes further, that because we are made in God's image, we have been assigned a ruling function over creation, disenfranchising the divine council member beings from ruling physical creation, which is just a fascinating idea, that implies we have been given a special privilege in all of creation to actually be the representation of God throughout the world, that we are meant to steward, to guardian creation. But the likeness, oh goodness, our connection is that we have a son or parent-child relationship with God himself. Mm-hmm. And that's just it was a mind-blowing concept. And I just really wished I had more time to just like kind of tease out Dr. Genshi's brain towards the end of that talk. And when we got a chance to just kind of talk with him personally, one of the bits that he just kind of threw my way that was like a little grenade in my soul was that he pointed out, this is all reflection of ancient Near Eastern covenant practices. And he pointed out that in the ancient Near East, especially in marriage covenants, typically what happens is that you would have a meal right after the marriage. After you do the whole entire marriage ceremony, the covenant's been established, the very first act afterwards is to have a meal together. And the reason is because, especially in this whole entire creation of humanity, what we're having at this moment is there is a connection between we are now kin. You only share a meal. You only have dinner with family members. And that when a marriage covenant occurs, the reason why so often in ancient Near Eastern practices there is a meal after the ceremony is because you're essentially signifying we have now become family. We are now connected to one another on a deeper level, to such a level as though you are now my brother.
Wow.
You are now my family. We don't share meals with people unless we consider them to be family. That's why the act of hospitality, of sharing a meal with a person, is so intimate, because you're almost essentially saying to them, I'm treating you as though you're almost like my family, but not quite, because you know this is not going to happen all the time. But with a marriage, oh, we are now definitely family. That's the first thing we will do right after the ceremony, is that we are now family. Mm-hmm. And so I, for me, that kind of just kicked off that entire process, and knowing that I was going to go into this whole entire like sermon series and going into the creation thing, it's just been mind-boggling. And so that's just like one little teaser that I just wanted to bring up of just Dr. Gentry's research, that it was just the image and likeness words are not just synonyms. They indicate even just a division of like, what is our representation supposed to mean? Hmm. There's a vertical relationship with God, and then there is a horizontal expression of our representation of God to the world. And that just blows my mind. That, like, my gosh, we just have not understood this verse as deeply as we have assumed for the last 2,000 years in the church. And that our function as human beings is so much deeper and richer than I have ever even assumed. And I'm still just, like, fleshing it out in my mind. But, yeah, I just wanted to share that little bit, at least with the audience, because that I've just been,
so
yeah.
How cool is it, Mike, though, that, like, how many times do you think you had read that verse before that moment?
Countless times,
like,
right?
I know this verse. I've read it. I see it. I've even eaten wedding meals. You know, I mean, in our culture, I guess you take the pictures maybe afterwards. But I mean, it's the same thing. But I love how deep Scripture is, and just looking at the words and knowing the background behind how these words were used, and knowing the historical context. It just adds so much depth and light to what's being said, because it does go on and talk about dominion and all that stuff there. But those words, that's a perfect bridge into what the author of Genesis wrote.
And I think, you know, it's just one of these interesting little bits is, right, like we've made the image of God into like characteristics, right? Like the first mind-blowing thing for me years ago was learning Dr. Heiser's material and realizing that it isn't talking about, you know, some sort of trait or attribute, like intelligence or emotion or self-consciousness. Because there's so many other ways, as we're discovering through science, that animals like elephants have emotion. Mice have intelligence. They can figure out problems. Crows have the ability to recognize faces. Like if we limit the image of God to some sort of characteristic, we're at risk of, well, we're diminishing the beauty of that. Hmm. The other thing I would say also to the audience, right? Dr. Gentry's study was only possible because he is actually willing to study the other cognate languages. This includes things like Akkadian, Ugaritic. You know, like he's looking at the other related languages of Hebrew. And too often when we do our biblical studies, a lot of folks are used to using older tools like Strong's numbers. Not to say they're bad, but they are limited because they're not accessing the latest in language research in biblical studies. Hmm. And so this to me, I think over time, as this continues to propagate out, as people start realizing and digging and testing Gentry's like hypothesis, I think this is going to start revising how we even understand Genesis 1:26, because it's more than just simply, I'm bearing an image. We actually have a vocation. Hmm. And we have a weighty responsibility in creation, right? We are supposed to be stewards and guardians of this world. We're supposed to keep and tend to the garden. We're supposed to take care of creation. It isn't something that we're just simply, well, it's all going to burn. Hmm. We are supposed to take care of it.
So the name of the book we have to be wise about is Biblical Studies by Peter J. Gentry. Looks like it's about 16 mm-hmm. bucks, 17 bucks. So it's not a giant, it's not like buying a dictionary of deities and demons or something like that, which is going to set you way back. But this is very affordable.
Yep. And it is also coming out on Logos in a few months as well.
Ooh, I like to hear that.
So if people are more interested, yeah. So if people are interested in that, they can also wait for that too. I couldn't. So I got the physical one as well. The other thing that I want to mention is this book from one of my Hebrew professors, Dr. Catherine McDowell. This is a book version of her PhD dissertation, The Image of God in the Garden of Eden. And I actually had gotten the chance before Dr. Heiser had passed a few years. You know, I actually mentioned this to him a few years ago. He turns out he actually read it later, and he loved her material. Because she essentially took what he mentioned in Unseen Realm. He mentioned this one ritual practice called the opening of the mouth. Hmm. And it was this idea where when idols were created, especially for temple worship, one of the ways they consecrated that idol was they would do a ceremony called opening of the mouth. They would pretend to open the mouth of the idol, and they would invite the spirit of the deity to leave a little bit of his or her essence in that statue, so that all of a sudden that statue became a representation, a representative of that god to the physical world. She took that and went further on and to actually discover that there were other ceremonies that were also done to consecrate these kind of statues and idols. And her question ultimately was diving into, can we look at Genesis 2 and see the same kind of idea of Genesis 1:26 of representation, of creating a representative in the physical world of Yahweh in Genesis 2. And essentially in Genesis 2 and 3, she finds that research bearing out. I would encourage folks to check it out. I'm still chewing over this even after a few years of reading it. I'm still rereading it because the material is dense. And she dives into, again, the cognate languages, Ugaritic, Akkadian, Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic. It's a lot. To do this kind of research takes a long time, and I am so grateful to folks like my professor. Key things I would bring out from Genesis, especially Genesis chapter 3, and this was actually related to what my sermon was talking about. For example, haven't we always asked that question? It's like, why is it that after Adam and his wife ate from the tree of knowledge, why is it that they all of a sudden realized that they were naked and they felt shame? Because they were naked before.
Right.
But why is it? What happened? What happened after they ate the fruit, right? And then it brings up questions. Was there something special about the fruit? Was there something like a special quality? In her research, it turns out most likely what's actually going on is that the ancient audience had this understanding or had this kind of presumption that is not explained explicitly in the text, but is mentioned in other extra biblical texts, especially in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are allusions to this, that Adam and his wife were clothed. They were naked, but they were not physically clothed, sure, but they were clothed. They were clothed with God's glory. I'll read the section from her book on page 165. It's in the chapter that's dealing with the meaning of Selim and the moot, just like Peter Gentry. That's why actually Peter Gentry mentions Dr. McDowell's material extensively, because she dived into what those two words were. On page 165, she has a section called The Garments of Adam and Eve, ? The notion that the primordial pair donned some type of glorious covering is an ancient one. As noted above, already in Psalm 8, verses 6 or verse 5, depending on what version of the scriptures you're looking at, Septuagint or English, Adam and Eve are described as crowned with glory and splendor. In Sirach 49:16, this is a 2nd century BC document, mentions the splendor of Adam above all living creatures in a context which associates the high priestly vestments of Simon, son of Onus, with Adam's primordial glory. Similarly, the Damascus document from the Quran, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, quote, "Now those who remain steadfast in it will acquire eternal life, and all the glory of Adam is for them." Likewise, the Qumran community rule, again also from the Dead Sea Scrolls, states, "For those God has chosen for an everlasting covenant, and for them is all the glory of Adam." Both of these texts from Qumran imply a belief among the Essenes that prior to the events of Genesis 3:7, Adam possessed a measure of Yahweh's glory, which they themselves would inherit in the eschaton. Layden, she's quoting from another scholar, comments, "It is a commonly held scholarly viewpoint that the Qumran Jews expected to receive, or had already in a certain measure, a share of the glory lost by Adam." She and then eventually another scholar, Dr. Ingrid Farrell, they go on to this idea that what was lost at the moment when Adam, when his wife and then Adam eating from the fruit of knowledge, that what was lost was actually the glory of God that they were clothed in. They were already naked, but then now they felt shame because all of a sudden, very clearly to them, they lost the vestments of glory that they were wearing. I would highly recommend folks really digging into her research and reading, because she goes into essentially everything about the creation account in Genesis 2, about Adam being formed, the fact that God breathed into Adam his breath of life. There are allusions to these rituals of opening of the mouth, opening of the eyes, opening of the nose, of the ears, that all these rituals of preparing a statue for a temple to be a representation of a god in a temple. There are these allusions in the Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 chapters that would remind folks of those practices. And the irony is that when they eat the fruit, there is this moment where the text says their eyes were open, right? That the serpent said, "If once you eat of this fruit, your eyes will be open." That is an allusion to a ceremony known as the opening of the eyes. And I'll read this part from her work here. Let me make sure I get the tap part. In the Eden story, the opening of the eyes is likewise significant. The serpent claims, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil." If the author of Genesis 2 was familiar with these ceremonies, with the opening of the mouth, the opening of the eyes, or rather simply the idea that the animation of the sensory organs was thought to enliven a divine statue, then his reference to the opening of the eyes and becoming like Elohim may have been a subtle allusion to this practice. In each case, the opening of the eyes was not only an act of animation, but of divination, or in Genesis 3, 5 to 6, an attempt by Adam and Eve at divination. That ultimately, right, the temptation that the serpent is saying was that if they eat from the fruit of knowledge, they will be like the gods, right? And I mentioned this in my sermon, that the sad reality is they were made in the image and likeness of God. In a ironic twist, they actually had something that was even better than the regular Elohim. They were given divine rule. They were given the responsibility to be guardians of our physical world. And yet the temptation was, you can be just like me, the serpent. You can be just like all the other Elohim. You can be just like the spiritual beings. They were trading something that was beautiful that they already had for something that was really, in some sense, ordinary. Hmm. And they wanted to be like gods. And the sad irony is, that is what happened. They became just like the Elohim.
Yeah.
But they forsook the glory vestments that they were wearing. They were given such high authority by our God, Yahweh, and they gave it up for something that was just regular. Hmm. And that's just the sad tragedy about the fall. Anyways, so all that I went into that sermon, and I couldn't explain everything, but that was like why I was like so passionate when I was talking about it, because it was just like my goodness, my gracious, like we have given up so much in our fall, and yet the beauty of our God is that he was not going to just let us be in that state, losing our glory vestments, and that he wanted to restore us back to what we were originally meant to be. And that he would actually send and become the very image of what he had created, humanity, to restore the image, as the great church father Athanasius would say, that the image of God was fading, was breaking down, decaying because of corruption and of death, and that ultimately the only way to restore the image of God is that the creator himself has to do it, has to show us what is the image of God. And that is what we see in Jesus Christ. Hmm. It's, you cannot ever get enough of just relishing and meditating and percolating on the fact that we are made in the image of God and in his likeness.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier, Mike, a phrase that may have caught people off guard a little bit, because you used the word divination. That this was an attempt by Adam and Eve, and to most people, the word divination is gonna sound magical to them, and the concept there. But there is an element of the word nakash, the serpent, that kind of has a divination, magical or like omens and foretelling kind of element to it. Is that true?
It's true because the word nakash, the three core like consonants in there, they're shared with words such as bronze in Hebrew, and also with blazing or shining. And also with divination or wisdom sharing. And so there is that element that, like, it isn't a question of like, is it either or one of these three or four options? It wholly is possible that it could just be, it's including all of that in the thought as you're reading it. That is supposed to just bring up in your mind. So if you're familiar with a language and the words familiarly enough, one word can bring up multiple different meanings. And however clever the writer or the author is, they may have actually are trying to provoke several different meanings at the same time.
So the cool thing about
I could say Super Bowl, and I could ironically, you know, in my hands be holding a giant bowl, a physical bowl that has nothing but, like, you know, Doritos, nacho chips with, you know, whatever else. But at the same time, you probably would also be thinking, oh, the coming game this coming Sunday. Right? Like, it's and I could, you know, be doing a comedy skit and then I'm actually alluding to both at the same time and doing something with the Dorito Bowl that's a giant Super Bowl, talking about how I'm going to use this for the Super Bowl game that we're going to be watching. That's the beauty about language. And that when we see the word serpent, we have to ask the question, and this is oftentimes why there's a value in looking at the original language. Is the author doing something clever? Is the author doing something kind of sneaky, or he's trying to poke at you to try to get you to think a little bit more deeply?
Which makes sense, because and the serpent is sneaky. Like, if you're talking about him,
yeah.
Like, there's more to this character. I have read Genesis, I don't know how many times, Mike, and I am always finding something new that hasn't just jumped off the page at me before. Or I'll talk to a friend like you who will point out a word that I've looked at. Dang it, I've looked at that and did not know that. And so, like, the idea of kind of removing these stories from the flannel graph boards and from the VeggieTales version of these stories and seeing this is actually serious literature about a really big story. It's not a children's story. We may teach it to children, but there's so much in here. You could really study this. I think I could study this the rest of my ministry and not crack the code to have, you know, I've sucked this this bottle dry. You know, I've got all the pop or water or whatever out of it. There's always more in here.
Can I drop one last, like, this would be the last major thing I want to mention, and then we can, like, talk, and if you have questions, we can just discuss. But this is the last major thing I want to just bring up, something I really wish I could have fleshed out more in the sermon. But verse 21.
Okay, so everyone who is at Mike's church, you're getting the what he wished he put into the sermon, but the time restraints held him back.
If I had more time.
Yes, this is sermon 2.0.
In Genesis 3:21. Right, so this is after God had given essentially the promise, also, you know, the punishment. In verse 21 in chapter 3, the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. Now, I would not have noticed anything unusual about this unless it was from Dr. Farrell and also Dr. McDowell. Dr. McDowell just brilliantly pointed out how interestingly that it's the Lord God made garments of skin. The word garments in the NIV, in the English, the Hebrew word behind that is katotnet. And simply when I right click on it and I look at my Logos, you know, software, for example, it just gives a simple definition, a shirt like tunic. But if you dig into the word, you'll realize that a lot of the majority of the time when this word is used, it's used to describe the garments that are associated with the priesthood.
Really?
It's not your regular word for clothing. It's not the word that's normally used for clothes. It's part of the whole entire, like, you know, dress ensemble of the priests. What? That's weird.
I did not know that.
And so I did not know that either. And then, you know, of course, as a good, you know, scholar researcher, or at least wannabe researcher, I would dig into all of the different, you know, language studies and Hebrew words, and they actually do pan out that way. They actually mention, yes, the majority of the time this word is used to describe the clothes of the priests. And so isn't that interesting that in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3, that we're getting these allusions and these ideas that Adam and his wife, that humanity was dressed in the vestments and crowned with the glory of Yahweh, that there's something about their representation, about their priestly like duties, about what they're meant to do within the garden. They lose that. And what does God give to them? Physical clothes. Using a word that is alluding to something that's related to the priesthood for both Adam and his wife. And, you know, I want to address it. I was about to go into this different type of topic. I don't know, John, if you have a hint of what I was about to say, but I won't say it.
But well, no. You got to do it now.
I have to say, and this was something I pointed out in the sermon, was that both male and female, we are responsible as the priestly, kingly representatives of God in the world, right? When God created woman, the way that Adam describes her, she is, the way that God describes is I have to make a suitable helper or azer. And I couldn't get into the word. I simply just kind of boiled it down that the way to translate or to think about azer is not a servant, but a salvific helper.
Right.
A salvific deliverer. That in order for Adam to function and do his vocation, he needs someone who is equal and yet distinct. Someone who is similar and yet has unique giftings and abilities that he does not have in order to both accomplish the job, the vocation that humanity has to do. And I find it fascinating that Psalm 8 and then all these other materials and texts that Dr. McDowell, for example, pointed out, they all point at this idea that humanity, through Adam and his wife, were priests. They were tending and guarding the temple of Eden. They were guarding what creation was meant to be, a place of worship towards the one creator God. And I just find it fascinating that the word garments is not just your regular word for clothes. It's something that alludes and kind of hints at something greater, something more important.
Well, and that makes sense in the text as well, because the phrase that's used for their job in the garden to work and to keep the garden, that's the same phrase that's used of the priests in the tabernacle, which was kind of an Eden-like place. It was designed to look like a garden, it made of shiny stones and beautiful worked wood and things, but it was literally a mobile garden. And then when you get into Jesus, that seems to be what he's doing too, except he is the garden. Everywhere he goes, there's abundance of food and sickness rolls away and it's moving around. He doesn't say, hey, I bought some property in Capernaum and I'm building a really big building and you guys should all come up here and hear what I'm doing. Instead, he's all over the place. There's this abundance, this movement. Abraham does the same thing, doesn't he? He's constantly roving around and being a blessing, or supposed to be being a blessing.
There is this touch of the Edenic vision that keeps coming up in the scriptures, right? There's this always this longing. And in a discussion I had recently with Dr. Johnson, one of the things he pointed out was that and rabbinic commenters long, long time ago had pointed out this as well, that when we have the cherubim that will, the flaming sword that's guarding the tree of knowledge, the tree of life, I should say, because, okay, Adam and his wife, they disobeyed. If they eat from this fruit of life, we're going to have a lot more problems. And so they get exiled. They get banished from the garden. That's understandable. But it's very interesting is that the way the Hebrew text is normally translated and the words that are used there, the cherubim is guarding the way to the tree of life. Hmm. And we normally think of it as like, oh, it's there to guard and prevent Adam and Eve from getting back to the tree of life. But why is the word, the preposition to there? Guarding the way to the tree of life. And so rabbinic commentators actually wondered, is this a hint that one day we will be restored back to the tree of life? Hmm. That when the time comes, that humanity is not forever banished from the tree of life, but that we actually will be welcomed back towards it. And that the cherubim, yes, its current function is to prevent folks from getting to the tree of life. But then eventually its job will change to essentially guarding the way to it. Come back to the tree of life. Hmm.
Well, it's just a Revelation seems to end that way, right? With the trees on either side of the river for the healing of the nations. Wow. Katotnet.
And even in NIV, it translates it that way. After he drove out the man, he placed, on verse 24, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life.
That's interesting.
The other thing in my study as I was getting ready for that sermon was the tree of the knowledge of good and bad or good and evil. It is only ever mentioned in Genesis 2 and 3. The tree of knowledge is never ever mentioned again. It's just one of those things that just makes you wonder. It's like, wasn't this thing important?
Yeah.
And then never gets referenced again. But the tree of life does. Lady, wisdom is considered essentially like a tree of life. Psalm 1, the man who is desiring and meditating on God's word is likened to a tree of life. You know, like there are these allusions to the tree of life. The tree of life is important, but not the knowledge of good and evil. It's as though it was just there as a test, as though it was just like it did its job. We're done with it. Like it really, what like I just find it fascinating. It's just funny.
I love it. But I chose the depth of the scriptures. It shows the beauty of the artwork of what God put together. He didn't just slap together a bunch of do's and don'ts. This is art. This is gorgeous, right? So I'm looking up your phrase here on the shirt-like tunic, katotnet. It's also the same word that's used for Joseph's coat of many colors. That's wild. Like you just set me up for like hours of fun looking up this. I'm going to enjoy myself this week.
Well, here's that question, the coat of many colors. I mean, the high priest is meant to wear one of the vestments of the high priest was wearing essentially this giant, chess piece that had 12 precious stones.
Flavor Flav.
And Flavor Flav. But the thing about why precious stones like diamonds and rubies and turquoise and onyx, they shined. They illuminated. Like they thought that they were emanating light. And so it's interesting that Joseph's coat is described as a coat of many colors.
Ah, yeah.
So anyways, Joseph is also a very important figure. And if people have been familiar with Dr. Heiser's work, they'll know that he had interviewed a guy who, David Mitchell, whose whole entire dissertation was all about who the identity of Messiah ben Joseph is. This very this mysterious figure that seems to have connections back to Christ. Hmm. And, it just so happens Joseph happens to be, a big ruler. He's really in charge of pretty much all of Egypt besides Pharaoh. He had these visions and ideas. He saved his own family. And he wore this coat of many colors. Isn't that interesting?
Hmm. It's almost like it's not an accident. It's almost like
I know,
there's
right?
a plan to this book. I don't know. To steal a line from Heiser, he wrote that, "I dare you not to bore me with the Bible." But if you're bored with the Bible, you're reading it wrong. Like, you're missing stuff because it's fascinating.
John, you and I were talking about this before the recording started. one of my goals and one of my passions is that we have to get people familiar and really to fall in love, at least become familiar with the creation part of the meta narrative. Because what I've been realizing over and over is that so many people don't see the significance of creation. Yes, creation is one piece of the meta narrative, but it is definitely vastly an underspoken and under meditated piece of the meta narrative. And at the beginning of that sermon, I pointed out the New Testament is drawing from the Old Testament. And when you look at how the Old Testament writers break it down, the prophets are referring back to the Torah. The Torah itself, each of the books are referring back to Genesis. And then even inside Genesis itself, it's referring back to Genesis 1 to 11 in some degree or manner. And I would even go further. Genesis 4 to 11 is referencing again back to Genesis 1 to 3. That you cannot get away from creation. You cannot get away from the importance of what is there. Because it isn't just descriptive. It is talking about God's intention for all of creation. And we are part of creation and we have a role in creation. And part of what Jesus came to do was to restore us back to what we were meant to be. A lot of people at the end of that sermon, they came up to me because I pointed out, and usually whenever I teach on Genesis, especially Genesis 2 to 3, I have a habit of not referring to Eve as Eve until after Adam names her Eve. And the reason I do that is to kind of highlight the fact that he renames her Eve instead of woman, because the proto-gospel is announced. That is the seed of the woman that will ultimately bruise the head of the serpent. Sure, the serpent will bruise her seed's heel, but the bruise to the head will be the killing blow. That there is someone that is destined to come from the woman. And Adam then renames her Eve, because she is going to be the mother of all the living. And I have always meditated on that fact, that it would have been so easy. And we saw it a little bit earlier when Adam is asked by God, what have you done? What did you do? And his first reaction is, it's her fault. And not just her fault, it's your fault too, because you gave her to me. He blamed her. And interestingly enough, Dr. Farrow pointed it out in her work that Eve did not do the same thing, though. She didn't blame the serpent. She didn't blame God. She blamed the serpent, but she didn't blame God. And she didn't blame Adam. So it's very interesting that then after God pronounces, yes, judgment, but also there will be a deliverer that is coming from her. Adam's response is, your new name is Eve. It's not a name of shame. It's a name of hope. And to me, I hope that it was an indication that the relationship between Adam and his wife, Adam and Eve, that there was forgiveness that was found. That there was acknowledgement of his own failing too, because he was there with her at the moment of temptation. He knew the words of God better, technically, when we look at the narrative. And I went through this in my sermon with the congregation of just like, see how people are quoting. How did Eve quote God's words? How did the serpent quote God's words? Notice Adam is there right there with her. And he doesn't say a darn thing. Why doesn't he say a thing? He failed too. And in the moment after God says this beautiful proto-gospel, Adam gives her a beautiful name. And to me, that is like at the fundamental, when it comes down to a marriage between a man and a woman, and when there is deep hurt and even betrayal, you know, what ultimately comes back down to is, can we come back to a place of acknowledgement of our shared wrong, because we are still in the end one flesh, and to still honor one another as we forgive each other. I find it fascinating. He named her such a beautiful name. Eve is not a name of derision. It is a beautiful name. She is the mother of all the living.
And I think that is a good place for us to wrap that up. Pointing towards Christ, pointing towards identity and love within the family, pointing towards not just Eve as the mother of everyone who's going to be born, but the promise was given to her that the Messiah was coming. And so I hope that you have enjoyed listening to Mike teach, because I have. And I hope that you remember that Jesus is the God of gods, the Lord of lords, mighty and awesome.